Welcome to the new episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the 19th episode in our season on Haunted Hollywood, which is, as always, hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. It may seem like we've been wandering around the mean streets and dark back alleys of Hollywood for a long time now, but we still have some more places to visit before the season comes to an end. There are more stories to hear, hearts to break, murders to solve, and dreams to get stomped on, dented, and broken before we're through. Have you missed some of the shows from this season, or is this your first time tuning in? Well, if so, you're going to want to go back and start with episode 70 of the podcast, which will get you caught up on all the murder and mayhem that's already happened. Just keep in mind, the episodes in this season are definitely not suitable for all listeners. So if you continue on from here, you cannot say that we didn't warn you. Still listening? Good. Because I like this episode a lot. Not only is it about the hauntings connected to one of Hollywood's true comedians, but it's also a sequel, or maybe it's a prequel, to our last episode. We'll be talking about two blondes in this episode, both of whom died way too young and were connected over six decades by the same strange little man. So sit back, relax, and get ready to meet Jean Harlow, Sharon Tate, and an odd duck by the name of Paul Byrne. Jean Harlow was an American original. Funny, sassy, and filled with life, she was a born comedian. But like so many other comic stars of the movies, her personal life was filled with tragedy, including the mysterious death of her second husband, who died under very strange circumstances in 1932. She was born Harlene Harlow Carpenter on March 3, 1911, in Kansas City, Missouri. Her father, Montclair Carpenter, was a prominent dentist, and her mother, Jean, was an unhappy homemaker. Her parents divorced in 1922, and the next year, Harlene and her mother moved to Hollywood, hoping to get lucky in the movies. But after two frustrating years of pounding the pavement, they reluctantly returned to the Midwest. And honestly, they didn't have a lot of choice. Harlene's grandfather, prominent real estate agent Skip Harlow, demanded that Harlene be returned to Kansas City. If she wasn't, her mother would be written out of his will. And believe me, her mother didn't want that. Skip adored his granddaughter and spoiled her every way that he could. She attended private schools and led a privileged life, and her mother sponged off her however she could. By then, Mom had met Marino Bello, a married slick talker who had charmed his way into her life. While Harlene barely tolerated the man, Skip Harlow hated him. However, he preferred that his daughter marry the scheming Bello than continue her unseemly affair with him. After Bello's first wife filed for divorce, surprise, she married him in early 1927. Well, by then, Harlene, who had turned into a stunning young woman, was attending a private girls' academy in Lake Forest, Illinois. On a blind date, she met Charles Fremont McGrew II, the heir of a wealthy local family. For the bored young woman, marriage to the rich young man seemed preferable to continuing her academic life. So Charles and the 16-year-old Harlene eloped in September 1927. A few months later, Charles came into a portion of his inheritance, and the newlyweds departed for L.A. They bought a home in Beverly Hills and settled down to enjoy their lavish lifestyle in Southern California. Then, much to the couple's dismay, Harlene's mother and her equally as loathsome husband also moved to the West Coast, hoping to share in Harlene's affluent new life. Although she was content in her life as a wealthy housewife, fate intervened in Harlene's world. Through a friend, she was introduced to executives at Fox Films, and it was suggested that she try her hand at movie acting. Her friends wagered that she'd be too shy to give it a go, and to prove them wrong, she registered at Central Casting using her mother's maiden name of Jean Harlow and got signed by the studio. She made her movie debut in a bit part in 1928. Sensing an opportunity, her mother and Bello persuaded the young woman to seek a movie career. Jean was soon appearing in small roles for Paramount and other studios. In those days, it wasn't seen as socially acceptable to be in the entertainment industry. Well, not for women, at least. Jean was, after all, the society wife of a wealthy heir. So Charles put his foot down. He told Jean she would have to choose between him and the movies. Well, with a lot of help from her mother, who kept pushing her toward a career in films, she chose the movies. And the couple divorced in 1930. Jean was now supporting herself and, of course, her meddling mother and stepfather. And she began to get more serious about her career, and she was soon working more than ever. She landed a small role in Clara Bow's The Saturday Night Kid and some other movies, but her big break came about thanks to billionaire Howard Hughes' fascination with Hollywood. When Hughes signed Jean to a 5-year contract, he already had a movie in the works called Hell's Angels, starring Greta Neeson. Then overnight, talking pictures became all the rage, and Hell's Angels had to be remade with sound. Well, Jean won the lead in the new picture, and she quickly skyrocketed as an overnight sensation. Hell's Angels premiered at Sid Grauman's Chinese Theater in May 1930, and while critics weren't kind about her performances, audience loved her. The Hollywood publicity machine went into overdrive for Jean. A publicist came up with a nickname for her, the Platinum Blonde, and even used it as the title for her next film to plant the moniker in the public's mind. Well, she soon became known for her white blonde hair and her daring low-cut necklines. Well, people couldn't get enough of Jean, and she attracted crowds whenever she made public appearances. Women across the country began bleaching out their hair to match hers. While shooting Hell's Angels, 18-year-old Jean met a 40-year-old MGM producer named Paul Byrne. She became intrigued by him, and Paul had taken a strong interest in her career. He had arranged for her to come to MGM on loan for a movie called Beast of the City, which was released in 1932. He also used his influence at the studio to get MGM to buy out Jean's contract from Howard Hughes. It would have been hard to find two people more incompatible than Jean Harlow and Paul Byrne. Most of Byrne's contemporaries considered him a genius, although a rather strange one. He was born in Germany as Paul Levy in 1889, and he came to New York with his parents when he was 9 years old. He originally planned to study psychiatry, but that costly dream ended when his father died in 1908. He supported his family and later enrolled at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, graduating in 1911. By then, he had adopted the less ethnic stage name of Paul Byrne and went to work acting, stage managing, and writing scripts for silent films. His mother committed suicide in 1920, and Byrne was so ashamed of this that he often told others that her death was accidental. And for the rest of his life, he feared he had inherited her mental instability. Byrne later took a job in Toronto with a fledgling film company and then moved west to California when he realized its potential for movies. After landing in Hollywood, he worked as a film cutter and a script editor before directing a few pictures and ending up as a supervisor at MGM. In 1928, Irving C. Thalberg appointed Byrne his second in command. During his time in Hollywood, Byrne became infatuated with several beautiful actresses, including Joan Crawford and Barbara Lamar, who died from drug addiction in 1926. However, none of these infatuations led to romance, and rumors circulated that Byrne had some issues when it came to women, ranging from severe mood swings to deep depression and stalking. Most avoided him when it came to relationships. Even so, he did have a reputation in Hollywood as a sensitive and compassionate person, which, trust me, is a very rare thing in that town. And people went to Paul for advice, for help, and for sympathy. And maybe that's what attracted Jean to him in the first place. We'll probably never know. Well, in May of 1932, she was filming Redheaded Woman and was being taken out on the town by Paul. He'd never been much for public life and was something of a mystery man to those who craved the spotlight and the lure of Hollywood's legendary nightlife. No one said much when he began appearing in some of the local clubs with Jean because it was assumed it would never last. Soon, though, Paul began telling his associates that he and Jean were going to be married. Well, this was shocking enough, but gossips were genuinely stunned when Jean confirmed it. Everyone seemed amazed that Jean would consider marrying the nondescript little man who was 22 years older than she was. It was assumed that the marriage was one of convenience to simply further her career, but that wasn't the case. She genuinely liked Paul, and nothing that anyone told her, including her nosy mother, could change her mind about him. Little planning went into the ceremony, and in fact, Jean didn't even have time to purchase a real wedding gown. She simply went into a dress shop and bought an off-the-rack white dress and a matching shawl. They were married on Saturday, July 2nd, 1932, in a small ceremony at Paul's home. Then, to Jean's bewilderment, they didn't consummate their marriage that night. Well, she decided to accept this as a sign of his tremendous respect for her, but Who knows what she was really thinking? At a reception on Sunday, the bride seemed very happy, but that's not going to last. Over the next few weeks, Jean was busy filming her next picture, Red Dust. There were delays in production, which gave her time to spend at home, developing a dislike for Paul's isolated home in Benedict Canyon. It was far away from everything, set back on 5 acres, and Jean wanted to sell it and find another place, but Paul refused. He wanted it to be their home together. As the summer edged toward fall, Paul became more and more depressed, distraught, and exhausted. He worried that his new bride was unhappy. He worried about the house. Really, he just worried about everything. He began drinking heavily, while at the same time, Jean seemed happy. She told friends she hoped that she and Paul could adopt a child. On Friday and Saturday, September 2nd and 3rd, Jean was at work on the set of Red Dust, while Paul was busy developing China Seas, an upcoming picture for Jean. On Saturday night, because Jean was delayed at the studio, Paul canceled plans for them to attend a celebrity party. Instead, he dined at a bungalow at the Ambassador Hotel with married MGM producer Bernard Hyman and his mistress. Paul then went home, read for a while, and went to bed. Jean stayed at her mother's house that evening because it was closer to the studio and she had to go back early in the morning. On Sunday, Paul worked at home and Jean went back to the studio. She'd promised her mother that she'd stay with her again that night since her stepfather was out of town. When Jean talked with Paul that evening, she tried to convince him to come over to her mother's for dinner, but he didn't feel like getting out, he told her. When Jean suggested coming home to be with him, he told her to keep her plans and not worry about him. He'd be fine. And that's what makes what he wrote to her in his final letter even more puzzling. On Monday morning, September 5th, Paul's married cook and butler arrived at the Benedict Canyon home to find Paul's nude body in a pool of blood. He was on the floor in front of a full-length mirror in Jean's dressing room. He was supposedly drenched in Jean's favorite perfume and had been shot in the head with a .38 caliber revolver, which was still lying by his side. After discovering the body, the butler went running to find his wife. She called Jean's mother and broke the bad news. Then Jean's mother called Louis B. Mayer, head of MGM, who then called MGM security chief W.P. Hendry, who was at home in Santa Monica enjoying the Labor Day weekend, and Howard Strickling, the head of MGM's publicity department. Mayer ordered both men to go to Paul Byrne's house. No one had called Jean, and of course, no one called the police. When Howard Strickling arrived at the Byrne house, he spotted the dead man's diary lying on a table. He flipped through the pages and found the final puzzling entry. It read, "Dearest dear, unfortunately, this is the only way to make good the frightful wrong I have done you and to wipe out my abject humiliation. I love you, Paul. You understand, last night was only a comedy." When Louis B. Mayer arrived at the house, he wanted to get rid of the book, but Strickling stopped him. If it disappeared, the police might think that Jean had killed her husband. They left the book where it was so detectives would find it when they were finally called 3 hours later. What happened in the time between the MGM's executive's arrival and the police showing up? Well, that's anyone's guess. But when detectives arrived, they discovered a .38 in the dead man's hand. It had been recently fired. The cops found the note that had been written in the diary but didn't understand its meaning. It looked like suicide to them. Meanwhile, Irving Thalberg had tracked down Jean at her mother's house and finally broke the news about Paul's death. When the police came a short time later, Jean Bello turned them away, saying that her daughter was, quote, too hysterical to undergo questioning at this time and that she'd been sedated by her doctor. News of Paul Byrne's death was soon reported in the press and, more importantly, was making the rounds of all the gossips in Hollywood. The next day, the powers in MGM decided that they needed to force Jean's mother to let the young woman talk to the police. Continued refusal would make the distressed movie star look bad to the public, who at that moment were blaming Jean for somehow causing Paul's suicide. Well, on Tuesday, detectives interviewed Jean, but she insisted, quote, there was nothing between us that would have caused him to do this. Well, Louis B. Mayer was on hand for the questioning and later conferred with Jean upstairs in her house. He later claimed that Jean became so distraught during their conversation that she tried to throw herself over a balcony, but he managed to stop her. On September 7th, MGM asked Tallulah Bankhead to replace the still inconsolable Jean in Red Dust, but she refused. An inquest followed soon after, and the authorities began to piece together Paul Byrne's final hours. Jean had stayed with her mother on Saturday night and then again on Sunday. She'd asked Paul if he wanted her to come home, but he told her he planned to stay up late reading scripts. She didn't hear from him again and assumed that he'd fallen asleep. She heard nothing else until being belatedly told on Monday afternoon that he was dead. Well, the inquest opened up a big can of worms, one the studio didn't want opened. One burning question was, what had Paul been referring to in the note when he wrote to Jean saying, quote, "You understand last night was only a comedy. I thought Jean was at her mother's house. Did he meet someone else that night?" Well, rumors spread that the crime scene had been tampered with, which was accurate thanks to the studio, but the gossip claimed Paul had been murdered. The inquest, though, said it was a suicide. But what was the reason? Well, the inquest stated he'd taken his own life for undetermined reasons. Now, there was a lot of speculation about Burns' comedy and suggestions about marital problems in the bedroom. Some believed that Paul was impotent or homosexual and had been unable to perform sexually with Jean. Others claimed he was physically unable to have sex because the necessary equipment was way too small. The comedy referred to in the note was Burns' attempt to overcome his problem, they said, and carry out his marital obligations artificially. Well, the night ended in disaster, the stories claimed, and Jean fled back to her mother's house. She refused to admit she was at home to spare Paul's reputation any further damage. By this time, though, Paul's brother Henry had arrived in L.A. and was angry about the rumors going around about Paul's sexual inadequacies. He insisted that the gossip was wrong. Paul Byrne had lived normally with another woman for many years. And here comes the big twist. That woman had vanished on the same day that Paul's body had been discovered, and she was found dead 1 week later. Her name was Dorothy Roddy, and under the stage name of Dorothy Millette, she had worked as a struggling actress in New York when Paul Byrne had met her. They lived together in both New York and Toronto, and she often referred to herself as Mrs. Byrne. Under New York law at the time, living together transformed Dorothy into Byrne's common-law wife. Tragically, though, Paul's mentally unstable mother, who wanted to be the only woman in her son's life, committed suicide when she learned of her rival. Not long after, the guilt-stricken Dorothy was institutionalized after a nervous breakdown. Paul paid for all of her expenses. After he moved to LA, he kept the information about Dorothy hidden from all but his closest friends. Those who did hear about her, including Jean, had no idea of the whole story. After being released from the mental hospital, Dorothy moved into the Algonquin Hotel in New York. She lived quietly, spending most of her time reading and walking in Central Park. Paul paid her a monthly stipend, sent occasional letters, and always visited her when he was in New York. In his 1920 will, he'd left everything he owned to Dorothy. However, this was changed in a later will, which gave his estate to Jean. Well, on March 17, 1932, Paul received a letter from Dorothy stating that she was moving to San Francisco. He suggested to her that she stay at the Plaza Hotel, which offered a, quote, attractive rate, and that if she did decide to stay somewhere else, he would, quote, find some way of supplying you with funds in a manner convenient for you. On September 6th, the day after Paul died, Dorothy checked out of the Plaza and boarded a river steamer that journeyed back and forth between San Francisco and Sacramento. An officer later found a woman's coat and shoes next to the ship's railing. Dorothy was not on board when the ship docked at Sacramento. Fishermen found her body 1 week later. Her death was ruled a suicide. On September 9th, a funeral was conducted for Paul Byrne at Inglewood Park Cemetery, with Jean sobbing through the entire service. Paul's body was cremated at its conclusion. Then on Monday, September 12th, Jean returned to work on the set of Red Dust, the studio having decided by this time that public sentiment had turned in her favor because, you know, the show, of course, must go on. Jean's career continued, but she didn't stay lonely for long. She soon started a not at all discreet affair with the married boxer Max Baer, who not only killed a guy in the ring, but was the father of the actor who played Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies. Bet you didn't know that. Anyway, to stop the gossip about the affair, Jean was quickly and very publicly married off to a convenient and cooperative cinematographer named Hal Rosen in 1933. She divorced him 2 years later and then started a two-year romance with MGM leading man William Powell. By 1937, Jean was one of the biggest box office draws in America. Her chemistry on screen with frequent co-star Clark Gable always managed to fill theater seats. They were teamed up for their sixth film, Saratoga, but on May 29th, in the middle of shooting, Jean collapsed on set. She was rushed to the hospital and diagnosed with uremic poisoning. Her kidneys were failing. In a time before dialysis, the condition proved fatal. She was cared for at home in Beverly Hills for the next few days, but on June 6th, she was rushed back to the hospital where she died the following morning. Jean was only 26 years old. Jean was buried in a private gated area of the Great Mausoleum in Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale. Although her phantom has never been seen by visitors, some have claimed to feel her presence there. But it's possible that's not Jean's ghost, because she's still haunting somewhere else. Subsequent owners of Jean's Beverly Hills home have reported a lot of strange phenomena taking place over the years. According to an interview conducted by well-known ghost hunter Hans Holzer, dogs in the house seem to be affected most, growling and barking at a presence only they can see. These incidents usually occur in the upstairs room near the balcony where Jean attempted suicide. Lights turn on and off by themselves, the smell of perfume has been encountered, and cold spots are sometimes felt in the dining room, the kitchen, and the bedroom. Owners have also heard soft, disembodied whispers, a woman crying, and footsteps that mysteriously pace around the house. And now and then, they say, they spot an apparition with platinum blonde hair. Neither Jean Harlow's death nor the passage of time stopped the speculation about the death of her former husband, Paul Byrne. About a year after the inquest, a grand jury investigation into District Attorney Byrne Fitz revealed some strange connections to the Byrne case. Fitz had been the DA who had handled Paul's case, and while the grand jury was looking into some of his office expenditures, some new information came up about the Byrne investigation. It turned out that Paul's gardener had told the police that he thought Paul's death was murder, quote, right from the beginning. He said that Paul and Jean got along well and that he never heard Paul talking about killing himself. He added he didn't believe the note left behind had been in Paul's handwriting. Well, this information wasn't in police files. In fact, they had a statement from Paul's butler that said the exact opposite of everything the gardener said. The butler's statement was also disputed by Irene Harrison, Paul's secretary. According to Irene, rumors about Paul stalking women were untrue and that Jean had been the pursuer in their relationship. She also added that she didn't think Byrne looked particularly happy at the reception after the wedding, for whatever that's worth. But most intriguing of the new testimony came from Winifred Carmichael, Paul's cook. She stated that the household staff had seen a strange woman at the house on Sunday evening. The cook stated that she heard an unfamiliar woman's voice, followed by a scream. She also said that she later found a wet woman's swimming suit on the edge of the swimming pool and two empty glasses nearby. There's no record of whether the police ever checked the glasses for fingerprints or whether they even followed up on the testimony from the gardener, who said that he told detectives about finding a small puddle of blood near Byrne's favorite chair by the swimming pool. It was interesting, but not enough to convince anyone to change the verdict of suicide. Well, then in 1960, former Chicago crime writer turned screenwriter Ben Hecht published an article that claimed Paul's death was definitely a murder. Hecht wrote, quote, "Studio officials decided sitting in a conference around his dead body that it was better to have Paul Byrne as a suicide than as a murder victim of another woman." He wrote that it would be better for Jean's career that she not seem like a woman who couldn't hold on to a husband. But Hecht couldn't prove his allegations, and that story was buried again. In fact, it's still a mystery today, but one that remains intriguing. Could Paul Byrne have been murdered? And if so, who was the most likely killer? It could have been Jean, who only had the alibi of her mother, or it could have been the other woman in his life, Dorothy Millett. It's been suggested that Dorothy could have come to LA on the night before Labor Day to confront Paul about his marriage to Jean. If we follow this scenario, Jean might have been at the house that night and found Dorothy arguing with Paul, which might explain Paul's reference to a comedy. The women could have left the house, but what if one of them returned? Could Dorothy or Jean have murdered Paul and then arranged it to look like a suicide? Maybe. I mean, I guess. I mean, Dorothy being the killer is problematic. In 1932, the fastest transportation between Los Angeles and San Francisco was either the Southern Pacific Daylight Train or the Overnight Lark. Either method of transportation took almost 10 hours, and Dorothy was in San Francisco to check out of her hotel the next morning. For Dorothy to make it, she would have had to catch the 10 p.m. train, meaning that a cab would have had to have picked her up from Paul's isolated Benedict Canyon house by at least 8 p.m. However, no trace of any such call or taxi driver was ever found. But if Dorothy did kill Paul, was she the woman who was hurt in the house and left a wet swimsuit behind? If so, why did she bother to go all the way back to San Francisco after a 10-hour train ride, pack her things, board the boat, and after all that effort, commit suicide? If this was a crime of passion, why didn't she just kill herself right there next to the body of her dead lover? Well, unfortunately for movie fans, if Paul's death was a murder, Jean Harlow is a much more likely culprit. She could have become distraught over finding out the extent of Paul and Dorothy's relationship, returned to the house, and killed him. There are many who believe that Jean already knew that Paul was dead when Irving Thalberg arrived at her mother's house on Monday afternoon. So in this scenario, the note that was found in the book was intended to accompany flowers to Jean at her studio dressing room, but Paul was dead before any flowers could be ordered. And if Jean was the killer, there is absolutely no doubt that studio executives would have covered up for her if they even suspected that she was involved. Could that have been part of the reason they spent so much time at the crime scene before calling the police to make sure that anything that linked Jean to Paul's murder was gone? Or could there have been another woman involved? If not Dorothy, then who did the wet swimming suit belong to? The staff said they heard a woman's voice they didn't recognize, which seems to rule out Jean. Well, whose blood was on the tiles near the swimming pool? Who did the second glass belong to? Why was it never checked for fingerprints? These questions remain unanswered, and for many crime buffs, the death of Paul Byrne remains unsolved. Could this be why his ghost once appeared in the house at Benedict Canyon? It's possible that he made an appearance to protest the fact that his death was never adequately explained, but I don't believe that's the case. I believe his otherworldly appearance was meant as a warning, a premonition for another beautiful blonde actress that, if she'd understood what it meant, might have saved her life. That actress's name was Sharon Tate. Sharon had been born in Dallas, Texas in 1943, and for most of her childhood, she'd lived in one city after the next, wherever her father, an officer in the Army, was stationed. Growing up, she entered a few beauty contests, but then around 1960, her family was sent to Verona, Italy, and while living there, she got extra work in films. She even appeared on a Pat Boone TV special that was filmed in Venice. On the set of a movie called Adventures of a Young Man, she met a handsome star named Richard Boehmer. They dated briefly, and Richard suggested that Sharon try her luck in Hollywood. When her family returned to the States, she called Richard's agent, who agreed to represent her. And before long, she was cast in an assortment of small roles and began modeling in print ads. In October 1964, Sharon went to a party at the famous Whiskey A Go-Go on the Sunset Strip, and it was there that she met Jay Sebring, a hairstylist with famous clients like Warren Beatty, Kirk Douglas, Steve McQueen, and Jim Morrison. Sharon and Jay hit it off immediately, and it turned out to be perfect timing. Sharon had just gotten out of a bad relationship, and Jay was going through a divorce. Once his divorce was final in 1965, the couple got engaged. Sebring bought a dream house in Benedict Canyon from former MGM actress and dancer Sally Forrest. It had once belonged to an MGM executive named Paul Byrne. In fact, he died there, and Jay knew it. In fact, he always worried that the house might be jinxed. He knew about Paul's suicide, but he also knew that two people had later drowned in the pool. Well, one night in 1966, Sharon stayed alone at Jay's house. Besides his studio in LA, he also had salons in New York and London, so he was frequently away on business. Sharon had stayed alone at the house many times, but on this particular night, she had a hard time getting to sleep. She said that she was awake in Jay's room with all the lights on, and she was very uncomfortable, although she couldn't explain why. She felt funny, she later told reporter Dick Kleiner, and was frightened by every little sound she heard. Well, suddenly, a person that she described as a, quote, creepy little man walked into the bedroom. He was a small, compact man with dark hair and a mustache. He ignored Sharon and wandered about the room, apparently looking for something. Frightened, Sharon put on a robe and hurried out of the bedroom, afraid to look back. She was later convinced that the man she saw in the bedroom was Paul Byrne. Well, the ghost of Paul Byrne is scary enough, but what happened next is truly terrifying, especially when we consider the events that would happen 3 years in the future. Sharon started down the stairs, but halfway down them, froze in shock. There was a figure tied to the staircase posts at the bottom of the steps. She couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. However, she could clearly see that the figure's throat had been cut. There was blood everywhere, but only for a moment. It was there long enough for Sharon to get a really good look at it, and then the apparition vanished. Shaken, Sharon went into the living room to pour herself a drink, but she couldn't find where Jay kept the alcohol. She felt an inexplicable urge to press on a section of the bookcase, and it opened to reveal a hidden bar. Well, as she reached for a bottle to pour herself a drink, she accidentally tore a small piece of wallpaper at the base of the bar. Well, she swallowed a strong glass of liquor and then went back to bed. In the morning, Sharon was convinced the whole episode had been a terrible nightmare, until she went downstairs and saw the wallpaper that had been torn away from the bar. At that point, she realized she had actually seen the ghost of Paul Byrne, the so-called creepy little man. She had also, unknowingly, seen a vision of her own fate, a macabre message that turned out to be a too subtle of a hint to save her a few years later. Jay returned home the following day and she told him about the horrifying things she'd seen. Sharon never forgot the event, but she did manage to put it behind her. A short time later, she flew to London to work on the film Eye of the Devil, and while there, she met director Roman Polanski, and they fell in love. Sharon broke off her engagement with Jay, but he took the news well. He was never bitter, and he even became a close friend with Polanski and remained close to Sharon, too. In fact, it was Jay Sebring who died trying to protect Sharon on August 8, 1969. By then, Sharon was pregnant and just weeks away from delivering her baby. Roman was in London, and Jay was staying at their home on Cielo Drive with some other friends when all of them were brutally murdered by the Manson family. Sharon Tate became a victim of the most savage slayings in Hollywood history, but 3 years earlier, she had glimpsed a ghostly image of the horrific fate that awaited her, tied up, stabbed, and bleeding. Was it a fate that was shown to her by Paul Byrne? Perhaps, but why? Was Paul just trying to protect another young woman from her tragic death? During his short time with her, Paul had tried to protect Jean Harlow from her overbearing mother and steer her career in the right direction. But when Jean needed him, when her health was failing, Paul was already gone. Maybe he thought that if he could reach Sharon, her life wouldn't be cut short in the same way that Jean's was. But perhaps it was already too late. Perhaps Sharon's story had already been written, and another beautiful blonde actress was simply destined to also die, just like Jean Harlow, at the age of 26.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans because I know we butchered some of those French names and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory, and Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Rosetta Stone, How Language is Learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like, where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where do words...
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today. For some reason. I mean, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah, you sound fine in mine, okay. And it looks like
all right.
You're okay.
Well, maybe it's just me. So.
It's just one of those days.
I'm deaf as a post most of the time anyway, so.
All right, you ready?
Sure, yeah, good. Okay.
Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now in season 5 of the podcast, Haunted Hollywood. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Oh, it's going. drove a lot, got a lot more driving. It's been a lot of back and forth.
I have too. I mean, I guess I did too. Two weekends in a row, I did a lot of driving, but... you know, 4th of July, all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Did you have a good 4th?
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah. I mean, I was in Alton the night before talking about the Donner Party.
Uh huh.
Having dinner.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But yeah, no, it was good. It was good. So.
You have all your fingers after the 4th and
stuff?
Yeah.
No, you don't need to worry about me not coming back in a hole. It's other people. So.
Right. Right. Oh, well, okay. So it's July. I feel like it's going fast too.
Yeah. I mean, we're almost like halfway through already. And by the time everybody hears this episode, we're going to be just like a little over a week away from the Haunted America Conference. Finally,
I know.
Which is usually in June, but we bumped it back a month in 2021 to allow the people who aren't trying to kill the rest of us to get vaccinated before the event starts. And they have. And so now it's almost here. And, you know, after we had to postpone it last year for the first time in 24 years. But now it's happening and it's coming very soon. So it's been sold out for a couple of months, but we are going to have some tickets available at the door. In fact, if you're going to the conference, go to the conference website and see some of the updates that I just posted at the top of the page. If you didn't get signed up and wish you had, There's some information for you up there too. But if you're not able to come, we're going to be taking you behind the scenes a little bit with the podcast, a special episode later this month. It'll be our conference episode, which we normally do. And then we'll be back for more Haunted Hollywood after that as we kind of cruise toward the end of the season.
Uh-huh. I'll believe it when I see.
No, we are. We're getting there. We're getting closer. Slowly.
Slowly.
Getting closer. We really are.
Oh, man. What else you got going on?
Well, we have a lot of some good stuff coming because it's now, you know, midsummer. Everything's thrown off because I always expect the conference to be in June. You know, it's supposed to be over now.
Right.
But everything's a little thrown off. So we're kind of getting back in the swing of that. But I'm excited because I actually have two brand new books out. The first one, a big one and a small one.
Okay.
The big one is the Hell Hath No Fury book that I've been talking about for a while. The 13 spirits, the wicked and the wronged, all that. So I've been really excited about this book. It's out. This is one of our most popular dinner events. And so finally now has a book to go along with it, with not the same stories that are usually I talk about at the event. And I'm going to just keep changing that one up. It's not going to always be the same event anyway, because I've got so many other stories and I plan to do more books in the series.
So there's enough crazy women out there.
Yeah, there's plenty. So the other book I did was called Horribly Mutilated. And the day that the Hell Hath No Fury came on sale, we gave away 100 of those for free with the first 100 orders.
I see the packages right there. You've been busy, boy.
Yeah, stuff's been moving. So anyway, that is what I call an extra book as part of the Dead Men Do Tell Tales series. A lot of times there are stories that I really want to write, but they're not, I mean, they don't really fit with anything else. I mean, they don't fit in another book. They're not really a book by themselves. I mean, a real big title.
Right.
So I decided to do these little kind of small books. They're only like $8. I mean, they're little small books. And, I kind of, after we started doing The Morbid Curious, I started to look at other ways that we could do things like this. That's just something kind of fun. So I'm just calling it an extra.
Okay.
And I put that out too. But this one, this particular one is about Jack the Ripper, but not the one that anyone knows. This is not the Jack the Ripper from England. This is the Jack the Ripper from Atlanta, Georgia, from the 19-teens. And it's a story that most people don't really know anything about. Kind of like the, you know, when I did that Victims of the Axe Fiend book about all those murders that happened, you know, like 40-some people were murdered, but no one knows anything about the crimes because they were all like poor black people that were murdered. This is the same situation. These are all black or mixed race women from the teens who were murdered. About 25 of them were murdered over about a 10-year period.
Damn.
But nobody talks about it. So it's just, it was, it's just an interesting story.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so I've been working on our scheduled Ghosts of the River Road tours, which I'll be doing in the fall. One at least is already sold out. We just put them on sale.
Of course.
One's already sold out. Others are getting close. I did put up all the Dinner and Spirits events for the rest of the year. You can find all that stuff. Dinnerandspirits.com is where that stuff is at. But I've got, you know, I've got those Hell Hath No Fury events, like I mentioned. We're going to have Edgar Allan Poe, St. Louis Exorcism, Lizzie Borden, doing an evening spirit photography about, you know, ghost photographs and stuff. The Limp family, on October 30th, I'm doing that Sinister Hauntings thing again, and it's really filling up fast. I guess I picked the right date for that one.
Yeah.
But I'm also doing one that I think would appeal to you called American Axe Murders. And it's not just going to be Villisca or just the, you know, the Texas, Louisiana things, but it's going to be all of these different from that time period. We talked about that quite a bit when we did our season on the axe murders.
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, how common axe murders were in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So, and a lot of them have ghost stories attached to them and stuff. So it's just going to be a whole evening of that.
Yeah.
So that I don't know how great, I'm glad people will have eaten first, but still, you know, it still should be fun.
I thought you were going to say it was like a haunted children thing. No.
I'm going to have to do one of those at some point because I do have that book, but anyway, the point is we have a lot of cool stuff that are coming. You know, people who are vaccinated, again, who aren't trying to kill the rest of us by refusing to do something that millions of people have already done with absolutely no bad effects, but that's okay, whatever. You know, I know people get mad at me for harping on this stuff between, well, like three, between masks and vaccinations and stuff. But really, I mean, when 99.5% of the people who die are unvaccinated, that should tell you something. You know what I mean? Who are still dying from something that should have been gone a long time ago.
Yeah.
But we have gotten this, over the last few years, we have become this country where we just don't give a shit about anybody but ourselves and how it affects just us. And so, you know, you get people who just refuse to get, for no reason other than people want them to. Yeah. That's pretty much what it boils down to.
Yeah.
You know, is that, well, you're not going to tell me what to do. Yeah, that's kind of like, you're the same people that wouldn't wear a mask. And see how that worked out. It was so great, you know. I just don't understand why people just can't do it. Don't people want their lives back?
I don't understand it.
And now we've got, you know, we got a variant that's running. And it's
the
like,
Delta variant. Yeah,
and it's like, you know, how much more incentive do you need to just go get a damn shot?
I don't know. I mean,
you know, do you want to die? I mean, do you want to? And the thing is, they're going to kill other people.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, we used to say, it was one of the things I always said, you know, this is nobody's fault. And there's nothing. It's nature. There's not. You know what? Now it is their fault.
Yeah.
Because by not getting vaccinated, they're causing this to spread. And as this stuff keeps twisting and turning and becoming something else, it's going to start fighting through the vaccines if we don't get a handle on it. Plus, they're going to kill all the little kids.
Yeah.
Because now they're 24% of the new hospitalizations are kids who aren't old enough to be vaccinated. So if you don't mind, you know, if you like to kill children and, you know, just feel free to just keep ignoring it. But anyway, whatever. People who are, I know, and I said I wouldn't, but you know what? People who are vaccinated are getting out doing stuff. We're having fun. I'm having fun. I've had a blast this summer. Going to have a blast this fall.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. We got tons of great events and I honestly can't wait. I love doing this stuff. I love to get out and finally get to talk to people again, that we used to would only look at them through our Zoom things,
right.
You know, and you know, I'll do some of that stuff too, because we have a lot of people who can't travel, who don't get, you get a chance to, you know, can't come to Illinois to take, you know, go on a tour or whatever, or go to one of these events. I'll keep doing the online stuff. It's fun, you know, just like this is going to be. Anyway, keep an eye on the social media stuff. Don't send Cody the hate mail about it. I mean, if you're so ballless that you want to put up a review and mad because Troy, you know what? Just send it directly to me.
There you go.
Because I'd just love to hear your excuse because you don't have one that's valid.
I'm not going to read them on the show anyway.
No, we're not anyway. So anyway, AmericanHauntings.net. You can go on social media. I got all the pages. Most of you know where they are.
There's
new books. There's, you know, new stuff. There's things that are happening. So anyway, you know, I think the majority of our readers are smart, or listeners are smart enough anyway. So I don't think that's why we don't get a lot of flack, you know, I will. Who cares?
You know,
I know it's a free show.
Write a review.
And I hope you enjoy it.
If you write a review where you're mad about what Troy just said and you don't have any grammatical errors.
Yeah, right.
I'll give you $1.
Yeah.
Hey, I watched Tombstone for the first time.
What?
I know.
Never seen it
before. I've never seen Tombstone.
Oh, man.
All your wider talk, I had to finally check it out.
Well, I've got that event coming up.
I know. It was great.
It's a great movie.
It's a fantastic movie.
And it is, I mean, there's, you know, any movie about history has got some, you know, dramatic license.
Uh-huh,
but
sure.
Honestly, it's a lot more accurate than people know.
Yeah.
I mean, most people think. It really is. There's a lot of that stuff that really happened.
Mm-hmm.
Not like the final shootout with, you know, Johnny Ringo. But still, you know, he did die mysteriously. We don't know who killed him.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We'll tune into Troy's event to find out more. Did you end up watching the Tomorrow War?
Yeah.
Well, okay. What did you think?
I think they made a really smart choice by not releasing it in theaters. I mean, it was okay for what it was. I mean, it was fun.
But it was really cool monsters.
It was a popcorn movie and it was fun,
you know,
but I mean, I don't know. Chris Pratt's a pretty good actor, but not in that.
Yeah.
I just like, he was just so stiff and it wasn't funny.
It wasn't
things that were supposed to be funny weren't funny. I don't know. I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
It was a good way to spend a couple of hours. I never want to watch it again.
Yeah.
But it was okay.
They're pretty close to green lighting second one too. I've already been talking about it. So I guess it's doing well.
Jeez. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably is.
Oh man. Yeah. Those are the two movies I wanted to talk to you about.
Ouch.
And I watched The Founder too, but that's different. But I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Let's dive into some positive listener reviews while we still have them real quick.
Oh, yeah.
This one is titled Great Research and Commentary, and it's from Halloween 15. Finally, one I can just read easy.
Yeah, right.
It says, I can't believe I didn't try this show earlier. Great escape from the stress of everyday life and current issues. That's surprising to me because this show actually stresses me out all the time. On a everyday
basis. Stress you out, I think.
That too. But yeah, thank you for the review. This next one's called Love the Show. Also a note coming a bit, ... and it cuts off, so I can't read what the rest of that title said. But it said, I just started listening a couple weeks ago with season 5 and just caught up. I'm impressed with the research that goes into each episode. I was very pleased when you shot down the George Hodel theory in the Black Dahlia case. These are very educational. Cody seems to learn something every episode, parentheses, a little tongue-in-cheek. Now the late note, after finishing the regular episodes, I listened to the bonus episodes. The Learn from History, Don't Repeat It episode was exceptionally well done. Troy, I doff my hat to you, sir. R.W. Rhea. I'm a little offended that you think it's only a little tongue-in-cheek, because I go out of my way to be obnoxious. And that's from R.W. Rhea 22, so thank you so much. And this last one's titled Limp Episodes. It says, absolutely fantastic. So much information.
Oh, I thought they were saying the episodes were limp. Yeah. You know, okay. Now I get it.
You know, oh, I didn't even think, maybe they are. No. It says, you guys are incredible. Great job. Seriously, who puts this much time into their informed stories? So impressive. That's from Coco Chanel Girl. Okay, got it. That's my bad. Yeah, so thank you very much for those reviews. I really appreciate it. Are you ready to dive in?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Took me a minute with all these names to figure out who was who, but I think I've got it now. I had to go back.
Oh, because I kept using her real name until I finally start when she changed her name.
Yes.
Well, it just seemed like the way to do it.
Hey, it made sense. You know, just in my head, I was like, wait
a
minute.
So no, I understand.
So Harlene Harlow Carpenter, a.k.a.
Jean Harlow.
Harlow.
Yeah.
Okay. Jean Harlow, born comedian. Personal life was, although filled with tragedy, including the mysterious death of her second husband, who died under very strange circumstances in 1932. So she's born March 3rd.
Really, this whole point to this entire story.
Yeah.
In one line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. So we're done.
Yeah. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
She's born in Kansas City. Father Harlow. Father is Harlow. Mother is Jean.
No, her father was Montclair Carpenter, and he was a dentist. And her mother, Jean Harlow.
Uh-huh.
Jean Harlow. And so she took her mother's maiden name.
Okay, sorry. Maybe it's my notes that messed me up and not you, or maybe both.
Well, I think putting Harlene in there for so long and then switching it to Jean threw you off.
Okay.
Because her mother is also Jean, and I tried not to say her name. I always tried to refer to her as her mother.
Okay.
Or, you know, so that it would not get confusing for anyone, including you.
Right. Okay. So. I appreciate it. Mission failed. So after a divorce, Harlene and Jean moved to Hollywood, hoping to get lucky in the movies, but no dice. So they go back to Missouri, because if they didn't, then her mother, Jean, would have been written out of her father, Skip's will.
Harlow will. Yeah, he was a really prominent real estate guy.
Uh-huh.
So she came in, and unlike so many of these other actors who came from nowhere and, you know, nothing, she had a really wealthy family.
Uh-huh.
So, and then, you know, when she married that guy, Charles Fremont McGrew II.
With a perfect name.
Who also had a lot of money. She didn't have to go into acting. She did it because she wanted to.
Wasn't it almost like a bet, pretty much, from her friends?
Yeah, her friends said, oh, you'll never do it. And so she's like, well, I'll show you.
Yeah, I'll show you.
And then used her mom's name, which, with her mother, I think that seems like a bad idea.
You know?
I don't.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, I can just see her mom. Can't you see her mom, like, writing checks and things using...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, well, it is my name, you know? And I mean, because these people are a bit sketchy.
Relationships with mothers can be complicated.
Yeah,
you know?
That is true. This is true.
So, yeah, because they move out to L.A. and then the mom and stepdad come out trying to freeload off of them and off of that success. You said in those days it wasn't seen as socially acceptable to be in the entertainment industry.
Well,
not for a woman, at least.
Not in her social circle.
Okay,
right.
Because they're rich.
I mean, because they
were
rich. And so, you know, when you've got these rich people living in Beverly Hills, you know, unless you were an actor and bought a house in Beverly Hills because of all the money you made as an actor, to go the other direction is kind of questionable.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, that's kind of lame. and I guess her husband feels what, similar, because eventually she has to choose between him and her career. And she chooses the career. Yeah. Good fucking riddance for that. But now she's single, supporting her mother.
She seems to bounce around a lot.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You notice that? You
know, yeah. I mean, I like her. She was, and she's in some really great movies. But, yeah, she does bounce around between men quite a bit.
Right. So. Yeah, well, you know, good for her. Her big break came thanks to billionaire Howard Hughes' fascination with Hollywood. He signed her to a 5-year contract because he's going to he's immediately going to remake Hell's Angels with sound.
Right.
And this sends her to stardom. So I'm curious, when they sign people, I would assume they sign people to movie, like three movies, not years?
It would
years,
be a deal. It was done a little differently back then. Like, you would sign a contract with a studio. Let's say you signed on with, you know, Paramount. And that's the only people you could make movies for. And it would either be a so-many-picture deal, which is more like it how it is now.
Yeah.
Or you just signed on for, like, a 3-year contract, and then you make as many movies as they tell you to make during that 3 years. That's more how it was back then.
Gotcha.
And then when the time is up, they'll either renew your contract or, you know, a lot of times you can renegotiate. Let's say you become a huge star and they, you know, a lot of times would renegotiate, or you get loaned out to another studio. Let's say you work for Paramount, but RKO wants to do a picture with you. So they pay the studio and you have to go work at RKO.
Ah.
So it's, you know,
gotcha.
That's when it was the studio system, and that, you know, that all gets broken by the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. But early on, it was, I mean, they had a hold on everything, you know. And at that time, they owned their own movie theaters. And we talked about that when we were doing, you know, the theater stuff.
Right.
Talking about the way the studios were and that kind of thing. So.
Gotcha. Okay. Was Platinum Blonde a thing before this? I'm curious about when that came around.
I don't, you know, I'm not sure where that, if that was something that they invented for her, but that's definitely what they, that was the nickname they gave her. Uh-huh. If you find some photos Jean, yeah. I mean, her hair is like white.
Yeah.
And, but that was a look, and, you know, it probably wasn't as white as what we see because all the pictures are black and white.
Right, right, right.
So it probably was a little more blonde than white, but it was definitely super light. And it became so popular that women all over the country were just bleaching the shit out of their hair.
Right.
And I mean, which could be dangerous because back then when you bleached your hair, you were actually using bleach.
Oh boy.
And so it was, you know, there, it wasn't Clairol and stuff you bought at the grocery store.
Yeah.
You had to figure out how you were going to do it. Mm. And they were just leaching all the color out of their hair to look like Jean Harlow.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did the same thing with Eminem in 7th grade. So.
Yeah, yeah. You know, lots of people did. Yeah.
So. And I'm already blonde.
Yeah.
While shooting Hell's Angels, 18-year-old Jean met a 40-year-old MGM producer named Paul Byrne. Said it would have been hard to find two people more incompatible than Jean Harlow and Paul Byrne. Most of Byrne's contemporaries considered him a genius, although a rather strange one. So let's talk about this strange little man here. He's born in Germany as Paul Levy. Had dreams of going into psychiatry, but when his father passed away, he had to support his family. Which kind of baffles me. So, like, he does that by stage acting. And
I know, right?
Like that.
And ends up, but then he ends up going to school or, you know, college for it. And, you know, it works as an actor, but mostly works as like a producer and a writer and a stage manager. And, of course, changed his name, which was common at the time.
Yeah.
You know, to something a little less ethnic than Levy, you know, you know, so
got it. He moves up to second in command at MGM though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think the guy was, you know, really great at what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that he really had a great career as a producer and a writer and that kind of thing. He was just, kind of an odd duck.
Yeah.
I mean, he just had a lot of weird, you know, and you can't always go by everything you read about Hollywood. I mean, a lot of rumors and things went around, and a lot of gossip ends up in print and things. And so you don't really know. But the odd thing about him is just that if you see a picture of the two of them together,
yeah,
it's like, I mean, they are night and day. It's like, what in the world? I mean, it just, no one could wrap their head around it. And it's even now, it's even still hard to understand. And, you know, we think a little differently than people did in the 30s as far as, you know, looks and that kind of thing. And, you know, people are much more apt these days to realize that they're maybe more under the surface than just looks. But even so, I mean, he's just an a creepy little man. I mean, that's just what, you know, I don't think Sharon was completely off in how she referred to him.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious too, because you talked about, you know, rumors he had issues with women, but also had a reputation for being sensitive, compassionate. And it kind of goes back and forth. Like, what do you think? Do you think it was both just because he's a weird guy?
Yeah, or? No, I think he, I think, honestly, I think he probably gets a kind of a bad rap.
Okay.
I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying. They don't look compatible at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he probably got a bad rap because, and there has been some speculation about that, that he may have been gay. And back then, you could not come out and admit to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one did. And so a lot of studios would set, you know, gay actors, men and women, up with people that they could marry as a beard, you know, because they had to, you know, keep up this. I mean, the studios, other actors and things would know, you know, and it would be a secret that would be kept from the public because the public could not handle information like that at the time.
Yeah.
But for them to go out and do these things, they had to have a woman with them or, you know, and it's very possible that he just didn't want to admit it, you know, and so he would pursue these, you know, impossible women. You know, he kept going after women that, you know, like, you know, I talked a little bit about Joan Crawford and Barbara Lamar with her drug addiction. He would always go after these unattainable women, and it would seem stalkerish and strange, but I think it was maybe, and this is just a maybe, but it may have been more out of desperation, you know, to keep up a good front.
Sure.
You know, and that may, I mean, I'm going to say he probably liked Jean. Jean liked him.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the one who pursued him, according to most people. And we don't know. We'll never know about their private life as far as what was going on. But obviously something was, you know, and he did have this, as we find out later, this woman in his past that he had spent a lot of time with, too, that he'd been supporting. And so it's, I don't know. You know, I don't think we'll ever know for sure, which is kind of what makes all this so confusing.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Well, let's talk about this marriage story. And then I went back later and added slash death story
once
I got further into it. So Jean's filming Red Dust, which is delayed, leaving her and Paul in his isolated home. She wanted to sell the house. He didn't. And I'm wondering, like, maybe talk about these types of things before you get married, you know?
Right.
Also, surprise me, maybe, like, you know, also sleep with someone before you get married. Just test the waters a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But again, all this stuff.
But again, see,
who knows?
Makes you kind of wonder.
Yeah. So. Paul begins to get more and more depressed, drinking, worrying his new wife's unhappy, which I'm sure is just a vicious cycle that kind of goes
But then
around.
Her talking about adoption.
Yeah.
You know, was another thing that's kind of an odd flag, you know, as far as what's
not,
happening.
It's not working.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So they don't stay with or see each other on September 2nd or 3rd, Friday and Saturday. On Monday the 5th, the help find Paul's nude body in front of a full-length mirror in Jean's dressing room in a pool of blood, drenched in her perfume with a bullet in his head. No one calls Jean or the police, but they called everyone else.
Pretty much. Well, they called the studio. Well, at first they called Jean's mother, then she called the studio because, I mean, we've seen this how many times before in different things we've talked about over the years, but especially when it comes to Hollywood and especially in the 1930s, I mean, who had more power in the city than anyone? I mean, than the studios,
right?
No one.
Yeah.
Not the police, not the underworld even wasn't as powerful as the studios were at the time.
Damn.
You know, so yeah, that's what happens. You send out your, you know, security chief and your, and the head of the publicity department out
of course,
to the house
of
so
course.
That they can go through everything and find out if there's anything that's going to look bad for Gene and the studio.
Yeah, you got to make it look good as you can.
Yeah.
They find his diary. The last entry reads, "Dearest dear, unfortunately, this is the only way to make good the frightful wrong I have done to you. I've done you into wipe out my abject humiliation. I love you, Paul. You understand last night was only a comedy." I think I'm going to start using that last line just in everyday life and just see. I feel like it could apply to a lot of things, especially with how ambiguous it is in this story, too.
Exactly. We don't have any idea what it means. So
I'm going to let other people just keep it up to their own interpretation. interpretation, but Mayer wants to get rid of the book. Strickling stops him, says he wanted the detective to find it so they wouldn't suspect Gene, which I think is probably smart.
Yeah, I think so too.
As I'm thinking, just trying to be PR and all this. So who knows what happened in the 3 hours before they actually called the detectives. The news of the death quickly spreads. Detectives finally talk to Gene, so it doesn't look like she's hiding something. She says there's nothing between us that would have caused him to do this. Mayer says that Gene later became distraught and tried to throw herself over a balcony. So, there's a lot to unpack and a lot.
Yeah, there
lot
is. And I tried to unpack it all the best I could.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just too many things that we'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one's ever really going to know what happened, you know, whether he did kill himself or whether someone killed him. We're never going to know.
Right.
If you had to ask my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he shot himself. I think he committed suicide. And I think for all the reasons that I, you know, was talking about, I think his life was just such a mess and such a, you know, he was in just such a state of, you know, and I think it's very possible that that other woman showed up.
You think he got caught?
And I don't know. I'm not even sure she did. I really am not. Because it seems very odd to me that she could have made, well, and I talk about that. She couldn't, it'd have been very difficult for her to have made it back to San Francisco the next
day.
It's just too far. And so I don't think that he got caught. I don't even think Gene was there. I think that's what shook her up so much, is I don't think she was there either. I think he killed himself because of his confusion over, you know, his own life.
Yeah.
You know, and he just realized that he could not deal with, you know, being who he was in the 1930s in Hollywood. I think it's a sad ending to the story, but I do worry that that's probably what happened.
What do you think about the blood by the pool?
Well, it could be anything,
yeah.
You know, and they said, and the wet swimming suit. I mean, I don't know, you know, but see, some of that stuff is, again, still questionable because that only came from one person.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else said something completely the opposite. So I don't know. I don't think it was ever investigated properly.
Sure.
I really don't, but
it didn't
I
sound
think,
like it.
No. And I think that the reason for that was, is nobody wanted to make the studio look bad or make Gene look bad. So, you know, everybody, they swept everything under the rug. And,
right.
You know, I'm going to say that, you know, Irving Thalberg and Louis B. Mayer probably knew more about Paul than we do, for sure. And I think they probably wanted it hushed up, you know, and didn't want it to affect, you know, Gene's career. It would have if, you know, if he'd been murdered, that would have looked bad. If he committed suicide, and that's what they decided that it was, but they never released a reason. Even if they knew what the reason was, they never released it. And I think whatever the reason was must have been bad enough in Hollywood in 1932 that it wasn't something that you wanted to talk about.
Sure.
So
yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't want the wallet to get light. I guess, you know?
Right, exactly.
Boy. Okay. Well, so Paul's brother Henry had arrived in L.A. and was angry about the rumors going around because he said Paul lived normally with another woman for years, and that woman went missing the same day Paul's body's discovered and was found dead 1 week later. So that's just the plot thickens.
It's just a weird situation because she was a secret, well, not to everybody, but to most people.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find out that he's, you know, been supporting her all this time. And technically in New York,
right,
they were married because they lived together,
common law.
So, I mean, technically his marriage to Jean probably wasn't completely legal,
you
know? So, I mean, it's a mess and, you know, and she's obviously mentally unstable.
Yeah.
I mean, she'd been in an insane asylum for years and that was a big thing with him too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that when I was, you know, doing the story is that he always feared that he had inherited his mother's mental instability.
Right.
And he may have a little bit.
Relationships,
you know,
with mothers.
I know, we're back to that again.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but then, you know, they find her dead a week later and, you know, it's nobody really knows what to say. And within the time that her body is found, Gene's back to work.
Yeah.
Because the show's got to go on, man.
The show must go on.
So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, okay. So she after she goes back to work, she starts a not so secret affair with a boxer who killed a guy in a ring.
Yeah. Max Baer.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Cinderella Man, that movie with Russell Crowe? It's about a boxer during the Depression.
Name, but I don't think I've seen it.
I'm trying to think of James. What was his name? Anyway, I like the movie. I mean, it's not completely accurate, but it's Braddock, James Braddock.
Okay.
But it's a pretty good movie. But Max Baer, he fights Max Baer in it. And the guy, he did kill somebody in the ring, but he's also, damn. But my favorite part of it is that he's Jethro's dad from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, yes.
That's my favorite part of the story is when you see Max Baer and then you think he was this like this vicious boxer that was, you know, really a heavyweight champ for a while. Mm-hmm. And then his son is Jethro. So yeah. Jethro Bodine. So.
Oh, boy. To stop the gossip about the affair, she marries Hal Rossen, cinematographer. She divorced him 2 years later. It started a 2-year romance with MGM leading man William Powell.
William Powell, the from the Thin Man movies.
Yeah.
Which those are great.
I haven't seen them, but I know who he is.
But yeah, William Powell is great.
Oh, so the first two are the way to go?
They're the best ones.
Okay.
Yeah, they're my favorites. The other ones are fun, but those are my favorites.
Got it. Okay, I'll be sure to check those out. Put them on my list when we get
to... If you're just now getting to watch Tombstone all these years.
Once we get through what they're doing, the 80s this Halloween or something?
Yeah, well, The Thin Man is not a horror movie, so probably never watch it.
Oh, okay, never mind. Yeah.
No, didn't we already do the 80s? I think we're doing the 70s.
I can't keep track of what we're doing anymore.
I think we did the 80s.
We'll figure it out.
Because we did shit.
Oh, I thought we just did the
Return
90s.
Of the Living Dead. No, we did the 80s. We've done the 80s already.
All right. Well, I guess we're just tearing through some decades. Yeah. Anyway, by 37, Jean's a huge box office draw. Clark Gable, eh?
Did a bunch of movies together.
Nice. Yeah. She eventually collapses because her kidneys are failing, and she dies a few days later on June 6th.
Yeah. And see, at 20, she's only 26.
Damn.
When she died, and she was a huge star. And if she had lived now... She'd, you know, would have lived for years because she could have got dialysis, but it didn't exist at the time.
Right.
So, you know.
Oof. Well, RIP. Owners of Jean's former home reported strange things, and dogs seem to be affected the most. Did we talk about this before, or is it just another dog thing?
It's in a lot of stories.
Okay.
You'll hear about dogs being affected by hauntings. They hear things the rest of us can't,
Sure.
So it's kind of like children and dogs seem to... be on a different wavelength than adults.
Yeah. Well, I think we've talked about it. You know, if I don't like you in the first impression, I might give you a second chance. But if my dog doesn't like you, what are you hiding? And so now and then, lights turn off and on, perfume smell, cold spots, whispers, cry, footsteps, all that kind of stuff. Now and then, they say they spot an apparition with platinum blonde hair. I would like this.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
That's the kind of haunting that would be okay.
Yeah. I'd be fine with that.
She was beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a knockout, you know? Yep,
she looked good.
Yeah.
She looked good. But what happened to Paul Byrne? So D.A. Buren Fitz finds some strange connections.
When they were investigating the D.A.
Right.
They found some weird stuff and all the stuff we talked about. It's all these witnesses who come forward who gave statements to the police, and the police never kept any record of it, probably because they didn't believe them.
Uh-huh.
But see, that's where you get into we're never going to know what happened.
Right.
Because one person says one thing, one person says the exact opposite. One says, oh, they fought all the time. The other one says, oh, they never fought. You know, oh, there was a woman here. No, there wasn't. You know, I mean, it was, that's why we'll never really know. I mean, you can shade all of this stuff any way you want to make it sound like more of a conspiracy.
Right.
Because really, honestly, I dug into this because I think it's an interesting story and presented it to everybody to keep the mystery alive. But honestly, in my opinion, it's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. I think he killed himself and left a note that was very ambiguous. And so, you know, there have been sleazy gossip stuff written about all this stuff because it leaves it open for it.
Right.
You know, the whole thing leaves it open for, you know, to come up with a mystery or a conspiracy. You know, did Dorothy kill him? Did Jean kill him? You know, I mean, Jean's more of a suspect than Dorothy because I just don't think there's any way Dorothy could have come to LA and got back to San Francisco the next day. But I honestly don't think Jean killed him either, but she certainly is a better suspect.
Right.
She could have.
Right.
Let's put it that way. But I don't think she did.
Yeah, she had. Yeah, she'd have the opportunity more than Dorothy would.
Right, but no motive.
Right.
What would be the motive?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, okay. You ruined one of my jokes. I was going to say the gardener and the butler and the cook.
I know,
what is this, Clue?
I know. With the candlestick and a rope in the conservatory.
God. Well,
I know.
So glad I didn't make that terrible joke. I mean, okay, so yeah, like you said, we can't really keep things straight, but you know, somebody thinks they see a woman in the house, hear a voice, a scream, a bathing suit, empty glasses, who really knows? What else is there to really say?
Other than
this ghost,
Paul
story.
At least showed up one more time after he died
as possibly a warning. So yeah, so let's wrap this up with the Sharon Tate thing. So we mentioned her in our last episode.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, she played a small role.
Yeah, she was kind of murdered in the last one. So I thought she deserved a little more time.
Yeah,
Sharon deserved more time.
I like this. I don't like this, but you know what I mean.
Yes,
I'm glad we brought her back. So born in Dallas in 1943. She's an army kid, enters a few beauty contests, eventually moves to Verona, Italy, did some work in film and TV on some show there.
Yeah.
Dated Richard Boehmer finally, briefly. He suggested Hollywood. It worked. She meets Jay Sebring in 64. They marry in 65 once his divorce is done.
They just got engaged. They didn't get
married. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Oh, right. Because she breaks off the engagement to go
with Polanski.
Yeah. Ooh.
Okay. Right.
He was fine back then, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So Sebring buys his dream house.
But again.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a weird combo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, actually, Jay Sebring, too, a little bit. But not nearly as much as Polanski did, who is kind of a wormy little guy, in my opinion. And I'm not even talking about post-Manson Polanski. I'm talking about Polanski ever. Is kind of a weird little dude.
I don't know. If you're a woman that's into really weird, guys,
tweet at us. But here you go, though. There is an incompatible as Gene and Paul Byrne.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the odd, you know, comparisons here between the couples, in my opinion, anyway.
Maybe it's a Hollywood thing, man.
I don't know, because if you saw what you did, we saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
And you remember, you know, Steve McQueen is in it, is in love with Sharon, but he's like, you know, this is what she likes, these little guys, these weird little guys.
Right.
Like Polanski and Jay Sebring, so.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Sebring has the house that once belonged to Paul Byrne. He died there, and eventually you said two more people like drowned in that pool?
That's what Jay always had said.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if that's accurate. I haven't seen anything that backs that up, but that was his version of the story, is that he always worried that the house was jinxed because of that.
Yeah.
You know,
he probably just had a crazy party and they were just passed out. And like, dead. They'll be up later, hungry enough to eat up everything in your house. So she wakes up one night when she's alone. She freaks out, sees a creepy little man walk into her bedroom, but he just kind of seems to walk around as if he's looking for something, kind of ignores her. But then she runs down the stairs, sees a figure tied to the staircase post, its throat cut and blood everywhere, but just for a moment, and then it vanishes. She's stumbling around looking for a drink, pretty much, to take the edge off, like we all would be. Finds a hidden bar and a bookcase, but ends up tearing off a small piece of wallpaper at the base of the bar, which is basically what can.
Which is
her
only
the next,
important because then when she looks the next day and finds that it was torn, it means that she didn't dream the whole thing.
Yeah.
It really happened.
I think I'd be wide awake enough to like not want to go back to that bedroom.
Me either. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought too.
Yeah, she eventually, like I said, meets Polanski, breaks off the engagement with Jay, but he's still cool about it. Probably too cool about it. I'm going to tell
him. I'm going to agree with that.
Sometimes
one.
Being a dick can save your life.
Yeah. Well, there's that too.
But yeah, probably. Too
yeah,
cool
I
about
have
it.
Always thought he was a little too clingy after they broke up. I mean, it's like I always got the vibe. From the story is that he kept hanging around, became friends with Polanski and stuff, and kept hanging around just in case.
You
know
case,
what I mean? Just in case things ever went bad, you know, he'd be there. He'd be there to pick up the pieces for the shoulder to cry on. That was always my vibe.
Gotta have
thing.
Some
but on the other hand, he did
he
do
tried,
his best to try to protect
you know,
Sharon.
You know what? So, that's true. I'll stop.
So I'll give him that.
Him.
Yeah. You know, so.
So to wrap it up, said Sharon Tate became a victim of one of the most savage slayings in Hollywood history, but 3 years earlier she had glimpsed a ghostly image of the horrific fate that awaited her, tied up, stabbed, and bleeding.
Yeah,
God.
I know.
So I'm happy we can end on a happy note. That's all I got.
Not a happy note.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to give a couple shout outs, to some new patrons that we have. So thank you for supporting the show, to Richard, Michael, Chelsea, Barbara, and John, which your support really helps us keep doing what we're doing. It is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Okay, Troy. So this ghostwriter, it's only one because it's a little bit of a long one.
Okay.
but it's from Renee. And okay. So I have to read it because I love Renee. So it says, hi, Cody. And she emailed American Hauntings and only said hi to me, which I think is very telling that she knows I'm the one that's getting those emails.
Yeah.
So, and she also messaged me this on Facebook, word for word. It says, hi, Cody. I have thoughts about why the Manson family murders were such a big deal across the country.
Oh, she sent this to me, too.
Oh, she did?
And okay. I went, oh, yeah, that's cool. And that was all.
And that was it. So. Okay. I'm going to give it a little bit more of a limelight. But said, I was young, but I remember it very well. I was in Kansas in a very straight-laced, typical
She's
family.
She's really old. That's why.
She's great. I wish she was my mom. The year before, 1968, the killings was probably the most tumultuous this country has seen since the Civil War. Then, in 69, no one knew what was going to happen next. The war was still raging, and young people were not only protesting the war, the draft, and the way universities were run, but thousands of young people were suddenly tossing out the norms and were doing anything they felt like doing and became anti-establishment, quote, in every way possible. Nothing was the same. Normal was done. I think the actual murders were a shock, but we saw war death counts on the evening news every night. Sure, it was shocking, but the news moved on around the country. The big scare came when the Manson family was arrested and it turned out to be a commune of drugged out hippies. I think that scared the hell out of those straight-laced normal people all over the country. Suddenly an entire group of people that the older generation didn't understand went from a strange oddity to out-of-control, crazed murderers. It didn't matter that it was a relatively small number of people involved. Suddenly, the entire establishment's fear had been realized, and they could point their fingers and say, I told you these people were crazy and not to be trusted. Hippies, protesters, tree huggers, they were all thrown into the same pot. Did you have to use the word pot? The Manson family became the national poster children for why we needed to fear everyone in that pot. I believe that... Sorry, this is hard to read. I'm so old now. I believe the reason that Manson and his gang are remembered still isn't because of who they killed, but that they validated people's fears and hatred of groups who had been breaking away from the civilized norm and lived life differently. That is what inserted the killers into the national conscience, and the mystique of the victims cemented the events into a benchmark in American history. That's my opinion. You
no,
asked
it's just
for
good.
It.
Yeah, no, that's a good opinion. I think it's completely on the nose.
Yes, yeah. She said, yeah, I sent this to the messenger. I hope you're well. See you soon. See you soon, Ray. I can't wait to see you at the conference. That's all I got, man.
I've got one
oh,
here.
You got
I got
one.
Something I want to mention.
Okay.
One of our listeners, I'm just going to say Emily.
Yeah.
She's been a longtime supporter of the podcast, but she sent me this message and I didn't know how to answer it. And neither do you,
okay.
Neither one of us do, but one of our listeners might be able to help her.
Why not?
Yeah. She said, Hey Troy, my daughter Gwen, who had her first investigation last summer, is asking me how to get her artwork into books and such. She does horror creatures usually, mostly stuff that has a creep factor. I wonder if you could help me point her in the right direction. I have no idea how artwork gets published like she's talking about. Anyway, so then she talks about the podcast, and how awesome I am. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, I told her I really didn't know how to answer
her.
But so if anybody out there knows anything about artwork or does anything with artwork or something like that, as far as illustrations and things go, drop us a line. We'll pass it on to Emily.
Yeah.
And, maybe something that would help her be able to do something with her stuff. So,
yeah, why not? Yeah. Let's use this podcast to help people for once. I like that idea. let's connect people and figure that out, because that would be great. One thing actually I did want to mention is my sister-in-law reached out to me, and apparently her aunt, Alicia, was talking to her mom about this podcast that she loves and kept going. And she's like, you know that that's like Samantha's brother-in-law, right? She's like, yeah, I had no idea. So shout out to Alicia. She found our podcast. It was recommended to her on Audible.
Oh,
and that's the second
nice.
Person now that's had it recommended to them on Audible.
I didn't even know we were on Audible.
I know.
I know.
I take care of this.
Well, that's fine. And that's good. But yeah, I'm glad we're all over the place though, because I've got a couple of podcasts that have come up that I've wanted to listen to. I can't find them anywhere. And I'm like, oh, they're on Audible.
Really?
And I'm like, oh, why? Just Audible. Maybe they paid for it.
I was going to say they had to have
they must
Spotify'd
have,
them
so,
up or something.
Yeah, something.
Or,
but,
oh, man.
Yeah.
All well, right.
Cool.
That's all I got.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for listening. And thanks for joining us for another episode and for hanging in there through all of our... Well, okay. I shouldn't say our weird rants.
You got
and
a mouse in your pocket
that,
over there?
Yeah, that would be me. And... you know, I'm not going to apologize for, you know, the things that I
wouldn't
say.
Want you to.
I'm not going to apologize for them. That's how I feel. And
thankfully, we have a place where I can say how I feel.
Yeah.
And you don't have to like them, I guess. I mean, if you agree, don't agree, whatever. You know, it's not really part of the material of the podcast, so you can just ignore it. Say it's one of my eccentricities and leave it alone.
Yeah.
So anyway, but thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. And we hope that we'll see a lot of you in a week or so at the conference and mm-hmm. maybe some of the stuff we have going on this fall or online or somewhere. So anyway, thanks a lot. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
And I'll be at the conference taking ghost stories and recording ghost stories.
It's going to be great.
If they're good and if they're short enough.
Yeah. No long stories.
I will
we
put
cannot
them,
do long ones.
Yeah, I'll put them on some podcast episodes, bonus stuff. And
Yeah. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. I can't wait. So this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written by Troy Taylor, and it's produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. If you're not a regular listener of the podcast, damn it, we hope you'll check it out in a bi-weekly dose of history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows. This is a different one. See the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos, links, and more. I'm your Huckleberry.
I just wanted you to hear
that. I love that.
So I figured since you watched Tombstone, I could retire Orson Welles
for
a while.
If you're a regular listener, we hope you take the time to review us on the Apple Podcast app and share the show with your friends, neighbors, relatives, people you pass in the street, whoever, your aunt on Audible, whatever. We couldn't and wouldn't do the show without you. If you're a fan, then you also know that American Hauntings is not just a podcast. It's this whole crazy office that I'm in right now. It's books,
yeah,
tours,
we are,
events.
Yeah, we are at the office.
More, and our main website is AmericanHauntings.net. For those of you who write to us and tell us that you wish we had posted shows more often, well, you can have fresh content if you support the show on Patreon. It's not the only perk you'll get either. There are discounts, shirts, stuff in the mail, all kinds of things. For those who don't understand how important our Patreon is to us, go back and listen to that first season and then listen to this one. Yeah, that's right. Patreon is what made it all get better. So check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And if you have any comments about the show, suggestions, reviews, jokes, clips from Val Kilmer, and just want to tell us what you really think of us, we're reachable via email on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Messages in a Bottle, Carrier Pigeons, and Telegram. Until next time, goodbye. So long.
See you later.
See ya.
I'm your Huckleberry.